нашей родины, красной площади. Как здесь сегодня все так честно.
Some of the memorable sounds of the 1993 Venice Biennale, starting with people walking across the torn-up marble floor of Hans Hacker's German Pavilion, then martial music coming from a kiosk behind Kabakov's Russian Pavilion, and as we are hearing now, a performance of John Cage's music at the Goldoni Theatre by Margaret Leng Tang, but this double issue of audio arts starts at the British Pavilion. I'm at the British Pavilion now with Richard Hamilton. Richard, I've looked at the installation here, and I think it would be interesting to start off by you talking about the underlying rationale of what you've selected to install here.
Well, the pavilion is very symmetrical, with a large central room that you enter through a grand porch at the end of it, the avenue of the Biennale, with lined with trees, and it's the most gracious position in the whole thing. You overlook the world, France on the right and Germany on the left, adopting rather lower positions, attendance on this beautiful central position. Of course, this is all harking back to 100 years ago, so It's rather silly to think of it in these terms nowadays, but by sheer chance, this beautiful little space, which was offered to Britain at a time of its power, empirical power, and it's a wonderful space. The symmetry of the building consists of one, this big room, two smaller but quite generous rooms at each side, and then they lead into two other rooms, and then there's a linking room along the back, which is the only room that isn't top lit, and it's the most difficult to hang in. It's a very pleasant space, but it's not really giving you the glories of these other rooms, which are very high, and sunlight pours in and diffuses with valerian intervening, but the light is so filtered and so diffuse, and it lights everything evenly, and everything I've taken out of its packing case has been transformed into this very easily seen image, instead of the problems that I've always had in hanging my pictures is that the surfaces are very uneven because I work on them for a long time. Some parts sink and some parts I have to revive with a little varnish here and there, so they tend to get a little uneven. I don't like to varnish the whole thing too soon, so I leave them for a while. And people complain about the surfaces. But here, none of that irritation is visible, and they all look absolutely even and splendid.
You've chosen to select works from quite a range of years, haven't you, in terms of your career?
Yes, it seemed to me that there was the possibility of using each of the rooms to enclose a different idea, so that the central room is a kind of political space with the rather big dramatic statements about Northern Ireland and Kuwait, and then there's a room to the left which is more perhaps sentimental with a mother and child. But the relationships that are possible, one of the things I've enjoyed about this particular installation and the possibilities in this pavilion is that the doors between the rooms are very large and generous, so when you're standing in the central space you have a beautiful wall to hang on which you can see through the doors on either side. So I've enjoyed the felicities of putting a new painting which is of a British soldier in Northern Ireland, and putting a painting called Mother and Child on the wall between the on the door that intervenes, so that the gun of the soldier is pointed at this child beaming out under the care of its mother, and this and the war games also on the other side, which is a picture of a television screen with the Newsnight sandpit being used by Peter Snow, And that relates very nicely to the other room, which is about consumer goods, the Lux picture, hi-fi. So it all seems to flow very evenly from one to the other. But each is a well-defined. Each room has a well-defined theme.
One of the high points for me, and quite a surprise as you walk through the rooms around the peripheral rooms, so to speak, of the main gallery, is coming into the room where you've hung lobby paintings. Reflected in one of the glasses is something you've, an addition you've made to the actual wall of the pavilion, where you've actually painted up some flowers on a feature.
Yeah, well, the curious thing about this pavilion is that the overall structure is of marble columns. The porch that you enter by has six grand marble columns holding up portico. And the walls that have been built inside to make the rooms of the gallery seem to have been forced into utilizing some existing pillars. The whole structure might have been quite open. Probably it existed before it existed as a gallery, and was no doubt fairly open. So walls have been built between pillars. And when I first encountered these rooms, I looked at these strange excrescences and lumps that appeared all over the place, which have obviously been knocked about a bit and covered with many generations of paint, and they're not very attractive. And I said, well, isn't it possible to just get a cold chisel and knock them off and flatten off the wall? But they said, oh, no, I don't think we better go that far. And so I thought, well, the lumps are so ugly that perhaps it would be interesting to see what is underneath. And it became clear that there was marble underneath this thick layer of paint. And I happened to have bought some paint stripper by error. I went to get filler to fill joints and holes and things. And I came back with this stuff, and somebody said, that's not filler, that's paint stripper. So I thought, that's handy. I'll go and strip paint off my little intrusion of pillar into the room. I put paint stripper on the column, which isn't really the column, it's just the base of the column that intrudes into the room. And the marble began to reveal itself, going through layers of white paint, and then as I was working further, I was told, this is Howard Hodgkin's green. And so each layer of paint was reminding somebody of some previous Biennale. And finally, I had to repair the plaster work around it, so I began to make this rather pleasant little shape that began to look like a vase. And I felt, since I was spending most of my time here working on this thing, simply because climbing on tables and filling the ceilings was getting me down a bit, so every time I needed a bit of relief, I could just sit down and work on my relief. Sitting on a chair, it was just the right height, and I fiddled away with my filler and stripper and revealed this form. And then I thought, this makes a very nice addition to the room. It's the only thing that one could possibly do with it. But it didn't look quite deliberate enough somehow. So I thought I would use it as a plant pot, and I painted fairly crudely, I must say, using the available colours of green and cream from the treatment room. And just put a few plants to make it a little more evident that this was intended rather than a hangover from something else.
I think as you walk into that space, the ambiguity between the illusion of the paintings of the lobby and the reflection of that feature in the glass suddenly makes one sense that one is walking into the lobby. It's a very strange feeling you have.
Yes, of course, this is a different installation from the normal. When the original lobby was designed, it was an 18-foot square room, as is the other installation, which was designed as an 18-foot square room also for the Four Rooms exhibition that Michael Regan organized. And here I've got two spaces which are about 16-foot wide by 20-foot long. So it's an altogether different problem, and we've had to make considerable modifications. The other difficulty, if you can call it that, or need for at least a rethink, was that never before have I had to think about two doors in relation to lobby. I had one way in and the same way out. But here, it's part of a circuit. You go in one way and you exit from another. So I can't control the thing in quite the precise and felicitous way that in which it was originally done. But it seems to work out okay.
Did you make some work specifically for this installation, some new works?
Yes, when I was approached by Henry Merrick Hughes and Nick Sirota, an invitation to lunch at the Tate occurred one day, and the subject was broached that I might be asked to do the Biennale in the following year. And it was raised almost as a condition that I should produce a major new work. And since I'm in the habit of producing a major new work about once every 3 years, it was a bit of a shock to have to take on the commitment to do something in 6 months. But I was involved in the process of creating a new studio in North End, which has a lot of sophisticated new equipment, so I thought, well, that'll probably help me out. But of course, the first 3 months I spent simply learning the programs of this new technology that I had acquired. So in some ways it set me back. But once I got things going, it moved fairly smoothly. And I was able to realize an idea that I'd already had. I didn't have to dream up a new subject because the subject was already in my head before the request came.
Which piece was it?
It's a painting, if you can call it that, of a British soldier in Northern Ireland. I'd made this painting called The Citizen, which is the Republican character. And then I made as an opposite side of the coin a picture of an orange man, which I called The Subject, because, of course, Northern Ireland people, the Ulster people, owe allegiance to the crown. Not even owe allegiance to the crown, they insist on allegiance to the crown. And then it seemed that that was the end of it, but I began to feel that there was a missing ingredient, that there is the British component which should be represented in some way. And I'd been to Northern Ireland a few times, and the first time I visited there I was astonished to find these characters with camouflage and carrying these Armalite rifles or whatever they are, and very often with paint on their faces. But in an urban environment, this camouflage, which is designed for woodland, isn't really very effective.
Red brick stick out like a thumb. Red brick might be more appropriate.
Yes, red brick camouflage would be much more appropriate. But the thing that I found most extraordinary about it was the way they walked 100 yards apart and back to back. So the guy in front was walking forwards, but he was followed by a guy who was walking backwards. And both of them were apprehensively looking at the tops of buildings to see that nothing was poking out, about to send them something rather unpleasant. And so when I thought of an equivalent figure, the posture of the characters in the first two paintings is rather important. I mean, this man who is confined hasn't got much freedom of movement and he's just standing there. The orange man is on parade and is outside, is very free, and the thing is much more spatial. And this new one, I had in my mind this idea that the figure would be walking backwards. And as I developed this theme, I began to realize that it was rather tricky to represent this figure, which was stationary, but to pose it in such a way that it was clear that he wasn't stepping forward, that he wasn't standing still, and that he had this backward movement. Because it seemed to me that this was, in a way, symbolic of the British position there. You walk backwards, they're trying to get out of it, but inescapably involved, but there's this feeling of apprehensive retreat from the difficulties of the Irish problem. And so it is an attempt to I think in all three pictures it's an attempt to show a sympathetic representation of the particular one could almost call it a symbolic language of the various participants, that the Irish Catholic wants to present himself as a Christian martyr, and the Orange Man is showing his allegiance to the crown and his historical position of the rebellion of and William of Orange and all that sort of thing. So the British are inevitably to be represented in this rather uncomfortable role of being a peacekeeper but looking like an aggressor.
I think there's always been a political element implicit in your work, always, I think, in various ways. But your recent work, more recent works, the political imagery has been much more overt. And I'm thinking of the citizen as you come in, and the treatment room, and the Orangemen and the soldiers you've just been talking about. I mean, is this something now that you think you have to deal with, some very specific, identifiable political imagery?
Well, I've never felt myself to have been interested in political subjects, in the 50s anyway. There was even a rather ardent attempt to remain aloof from anything, to stay cool, to make no commitment sort of glorification or satirizing, but to try and find a way between. And it was only when I thought, I've adopted this position, what would happen if I reversed the situation and looked for a subject where I felt some passion, involvement, you know, and so I looked for a subject that I felt an intense dislike for, and that happened to be, because of the Scarborough conference, when the Labour Party decided not to adopt an anti-nuclear stand. And it was all the consequence of Gaitskell's speech at that conference, which pulled the party round. So I thought this was a really just something that I found very distressing. And so I painted a picture which I tried to make political. I don't think it succeeded in being the passionate picture that it was, because I don't think I have difficulty in coping with that thing, because I think too much, I suppose, about the picture to ever approach a canvas in quite that direct way. But as time has gone on, I have felt a slight depression about the social position and the political situation, and I suppose it is expressed, but I don't think of it as being political. I think of it as being media oriented, and this is inevitably the outcome of looking at the media. You look at the TV news and you see Yugoslavia, or you see Kuwait, or you see Northern Ireland. It's inescapable, and I'm not going to avoid it, but I'm not going to on the other hand make it a critical posture that I'm taking. There was an interview for television the other day where The Late Show, and I felt that I was being asked to demonstrate my criticism of the government, and I had to say immediately, that's not what it's all about. It's not a critical position. It's simply trying to observe the situation as it is without taking sides. I think it's difficult to avoid the implication that I'm perhaps more sympathetic to the South than the North. I think that the resolution of the Northern Irish problem is inevitable, and that's going to be a unified Ireland, and that it's absurd that it's gone on so long as it has, and it's a historical anomaly that the position should be as it is. But on the other hand, I don't feel myself to be mocking the Orange Man. I think that is the dignity that he has chosen to adopt, and I'm perfectly happy to represent him in that way. And I should think that there is even a possibility that the person represented in that painting would feel that this was the way he would like to be seen, as a symbol of the north position.
The dialogue that somehow is created and the debate that's created by even the juxtaposition of those images, I think in itself is an interesting, sets up interesting possibilities in relation to the way in which the issues are usually polarised, and the imagery doesn't occur together any more than the politicians occur together. There's always a sort of fracture, whereas, you know, you dealing with them somehow allows some sort of dialogue or debate to be set up.
Well, I would like that to be the case, because I feel that that in a way art is going to be the ultimate solution. It's going to be the kind of expression which moved me in the television shots of the maize prison, that it is almost an aesthetic experience that they're going through. The way they're putting their shit on the walls is almost like an act of writing or describing their situation pictorially. And there's a very curious difference between each of the cells. You get a personal style emerging, that one cell you get a Rothko-esque treatment, in another cell it would be more Pollock-like. And it seemed to me that if you work for 3 years expressing this protest on the walls, it is a visual, but it's not just about smell or something. And then I saw also pictures of Mairead Farrell, I think it was, the girl who was killed in Gibraltar, and she was on hunger strike in the women's prison at Armagh, and her markings are so feminine in comparison. They're little tiny spidery markings, and enormously complex. So in a way I felt that this absurdity of people using their excrement in this way was a kind of artistic expression, as well as being a political statement, a protest. So I found the whole thing very moving at that level as being a kind of aesthetic. And in the same way, I think the Orange Man is a kind of aesthetic. The way that they present themselves with symbols, colour, the colours. Not only is the imagery of Northern Ireland about symbology, but also the imagery is very powerful in that way.
Just finally, Richard, I mean, here we are sitting on the balcony at the British Pavilion now, and the crowds are building up and so on, and you've actually finished the show, you finished the installation. What do you make of it now? Are you pleased with it? Do you think it's been a very constructive...
It's like Gooch batting for England and getting a century.
And the context of the Biennale, the razzmatazz and the range of work and so on.
Yes, I've always thought, I've never been to a Biennale, either as a participant or a visitor. And I've always rather scorned it as being a circus, an art circus. But I found that this particular year, I don't know really what other years are like, but I think that this particular year is a very good one for me, because it's the year when the oldies can get into the act. I always thought you had to be under 30 to participate, but Louis Bourgeois is even older than me, and Nam June Paik and Harker are not so far off my generation. I don't feel that they're the kids.
Well, now, speaking to Michael Craig Martin here at the British Pavilion, Michael, have you been able to form any overview of the 1993 Venice Biennale at this stage?
I think it's a strange Biennale in a lot of ways. There's something, in a way, Biennales are always kind of the same. It's always an awful lot of rubbish and a few interesting things, and you really have to search to find those things. But some of the pavilions are interesting. There seems to be some kind of strange sense of linkage between them in a way that is unusual. I mean, I think the British Pavilion, Richard Hamilton's work, has never looked more wonderful. I think it's a very successful use of the pavilion. the exhibition seems very coherent, and I think it's very striking looking, with the paintings of the citizen and the subject and now the soldier. There is that aspect of Richard's work which is political content. And then you go to the German pavilion, and there's just the most extraordinary piece by Hans Hacke, commemorating the meeting of Hitler and Mussolini actually in that building. That it is the German pavilion in Venice where they met in 1934. And Hacke has torn up the whole of the floor, so it's rubble. And people walk across the rubble of the room, and there's something incredibly moving about the experience. The whole it is probably the most striking piece in the whole show.
I mean, there's one thing that seems to have happened this year, which is that the normal structure of the Biennale has been fractured in the sense that national pavilions have accommodated artists from other countries, so you don't feel that you're walking into sort of mini embassies. There's a sense of an internationalism about this one.
That's absolutely true. I mean, besides Hans Hacke in the German pavilion, I mean, who one always thinks of as American, there's also Nam June Paik there, and there's Joseph Kossuth in the Hungarian pavilion, and there seems to be a much more freedom about people acknowledging both personally and for nationalities to recognize artists who are from certain extractions. So there's a sense of, I suppose, a certain change in idea about multiculturalism, which is hardly surprising. But it's interesting the way it's manifested itself here, by you're being surprised by who you see in different yeah. pavilions.
Yeah, I must say, over the last two or three biennales, I thought that the structure of the presentations were somehow out of sync with what was going on in the real world in terms of artists moving to other countries and working and practicing. So this seems to be a little more sympathetic.
Well, the whole structure of the Biennale in a certain way is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, we're standing in this kind of last vestige of the empire. You can't help thinking when you the British Pavilion in Venice that when Hong Kong goes, this is the last outpost of the empire. Sitting on the top of the only hill in Venice, right at its pinnacle, a kind of Edwardian kind of classical building. It says so much about the history of the Biennale itself. I think there's a real sense in which the Venice Biennale is an exhibition of architecture. It's an exhibition of the exhibition spaces, and the artists just fit in. They get slotted in, and it sometimes it hardly seems like it matters what the filler is, because the real statements are made by the pavilions. As it becomes more and more untenable, it looks more and more absurd in a way, being able to identify the country so much by the pavilions. I think that there's something else that I find very strange about the Biennale. There is a way in which it should be an occasion for a country that was not rich, that was not powerful in other ways, to make a strong cultural impression. In reality, what happens is that the richest and most powerful countries are the ones which dominate, and they virtually dominate every single time. And obviously that's a very complex subject about why that should be, but it's so very apparent, and it's apparent again this time.
Well, now, speaking to Bill Fever, Bill, do you think there are any characteristics that make this year's Biennale distinct from others?
I think this year the great change has been that Europe particularly has changed, and barriers around the world have come down, and the theme, all Biennale themes are pretty awful really, they don't mean anything normally. A theme which has emerged and been slightly imposed is that frontiers have gone, or frontiers are changing, that nationality is dissolving and reforming, and that people who are nationals of one country can actually live in another country and be kind of supranational. And a very pleasant development, I think, has been that most of the national pavilions have either hosted or altered their arrangements so as to deal with people who aren't echt German or absolument français, although, of course, in the case of the French, it is absolument français.
Yes, the traditional mould of this Biennale has certainly been fractured by the pavilions hosting artists who may originate from the country but live elsewhere, and then the Italian pavilion has
artists from countries that don't have pavilions. So in a sense, a whole sense of independent islands almost, which the Biennale always was, I think is dissolved, don't you think?
Certainly in the Giardini aspect, yes. Although, of course, money still talks. The countries that take it seriously, the big oil powers, which includes Britain, the countries that take it seriously, the results show in terms of presentation, quality, space, positioning, and I suppose you could call it advanced seriousness, because the countries that have little cubicles at the back of the lamentable Italian pavilion hardly have a look in. It's basically narrow parking space, and that's all. And it's token presence at best. You can't actually look at the work. There's not much work to be looked at. It's kind of obscure and drab and done down. And I suppose that does sort of reflect the state of the world, that the big powers speak and the money talks and status talks, and the Security Council nations do disproportionately well.
What about the pavilions here then? I mean, have you seen any work that you've been particularly impressed with?
I've liked quite a few things. I was at a loss to see really why Joseph Kossuth should be given space in the Hungarian pavilion. He is of Hungarian descent, but on the other hand, he does jolly well elsewhere, so why give the greater part of the Hungarian pavilion to him? That seems weird, and to do with dollars rather than anything else, hard currency-wise. The best pavilions, I think, are the German one. Hans Hacker has done a demolition job on Germania. For once, he's not used any words except the word Germania and a caption at the front, which is a photograph of Hitler visiting the 1934 Biennale and looking a touch put out. I think he had seen something that wasn't... Well, the Duce was slightly more adventurous in taste than the Führer, and I think he probably saw something that had connotations of abstraction, and this displeased him, and a migraine was coming on. Apart from that, the best pavilion is, I think, by far the Russian one, because Kabakov has done it again. He did it in Kassel last year. He's transformed a situation by appearing to do nothing. You go through the darkened pavilion, which is in decay. It's surrounded by wooden palisades, and you come out in the viewing stand, and you're in Russian, heart of Russia. You're in Red Square, and there's a little kitsch kiosk of Russian symbols, Russian communist symbols, blaring loudspeakers, and you are one of those men in great coats surveying the masses passing by. It's a brilliant and totally economical conceit.
What about Uperto? Do you have any feelings about that? Do you think it's strong, all the strong works there?
Uperto is strong, 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 gets stronger than this. It's, I think, tiresome that it's got itself into this bind where you go on for 2.5 miles or kilometres of people dealing with the theme of emergency, meaning by that, of course, death, matters of life and death, etc. And there comes a kind of competition element which is be more gruesome than the next. There's a nice smiling man I was introduced to who's been bloodletting himself at regular intervals and was taking a bit of a sort of a denk pause to recuperate his blood. There's an awful lot of preschool symbolism, basically. Some very good things are mixed in with it. It's promising. Our own Damien Hirst has come up very nicely, I think, with his cow and calf. Caused a stir, but it's actually a dignified and rather touching image, I think.
There's a much higher sense of interest this year in the Biennale. I think people feel it's sort of revitalised itself, rejuvenated itself, whereas in the past there have been questions as to the relevance of the model, although of course we all have to come to Venice and look at a lot of contemporary art. But this year it seems to be much more active.
3 years ago the Biennale was people still flush with money, and on these opening days there was a ghastly human tidal wave of people who were wannabe collectors, who were desperately seeking the right thing to follow and buy and enthuse over. And I feel that people generally are much more serious this year. And by that I don't mean solemn at all. It's a much keener, sharper, I think more intelligent general perspective that's been going on. Of course, there's 90% crapper than there always is, but it's, for a few touching and thoughtful, provocative things, it's quite a good year.
So, in fact, it's a positive model that you would like to see continue, this Biennale?
Well, I don't think it'd be right to abolish the national pavilions, which people always say, tear down the national pavilions, because they're actually islands of independence. And I think if there's anything wrong with the Biennale, it's the tiny strutting figure, Frank Sinatra lookalike, who runs this one and has, I'm sure, had a terrible lot of financial problems and political problems to deal with, but the idea that the whole thing should have a central direction and have a theme which is adhered to is, I think, a bit nonsense. The world isn't like that. And what's nice about the Biennale is the odd pockets of resistance, the odd pockets of surprise that crop up. And the ones that have kind of cropped up this year, the most nationalist of all is the Russian one, I suppose. It's also the most internationalist, it's the most historically aware, it's the most, probably the most economical. It's only got one small wattage light bulb, total power source, and a bit of loudspeaker power. That's the sort of thing which I think gives us the surprise and evades the kind of prescriptive centralist hegemony of the botanical direction.
This is proven by Venezuela's frenetic surrealism. The Bulgarian, but I shouldn't fool myself, even neutrality can be imperialistic. Paris was the world, according to the French, and still is.
I think you can feel Australian in the network, particularly that Australian desire for an Australian star.
She's on one of the ladies in the of this
song. Well, art is ugly and the Biennale is disgusting. The Swiss give the impression of unity. Poland, Romania, and Russia have repulsive installations which drive you out of their pavilions. They all seem very attached to the perpetuation of ethnic identity.
In der Tradition verwurzelte isolationistische Kultur zum Ausdruck.
Rudy Fuchs, what do you think of the 1993 Venice Biennale so far?
What we notice now, maybe more than ever, is that there's a kind of slow breakdown of what was used to be called international culture. And so years ago, you had the national pavilions, and the national pavilions were like islands, and these islands were very, very noble, and they would be there, and there would be smaller countries. But now every country has become a small country now. And so everybody is asserting his national identity and his national traditions. And so at this point, let's say Iceland has become equal to Britain and France has become equal to Bulgaria. So for some reason, everything is weird. Before that, I mean, I remember that, years ago we were trying to look before if we saw any common denominators in, the English, the French, the Germans, the Dutch, the Italians, where there was some common facts, and now we more and more I feel that we try and look for the differences. Now this is either good or bad. I don't know yet what it is. I have a feeling it's bad, because if I think of this, I mean, I think that what we call modern art and modern culture is based on the international utopia that there's something universal, and that the universal is something we have to reach by transcending our national things. Maintaining a national stand of a big country has almost no meaning anymore. I have this feeling. I mean, that's just a very strange exhibition for that reason. So it is very interesting.
Do you think that's positive, though, that idea of
I don't think so.
Eroding the hierarchies?
No, I don't think so. I am still a pupil of the Enlightenment. And I think that what Van Voltaire said, that liberty was equal for everybody, whether you were Chinese, Muslim, or Christian, and that there's not an Islamic liberty or a Christian liberty or a Polish liberty, that liberty is equal and is universal. And
But hasn't that happened?
But art now, art has become, it seems now to be, you have German art, French art, Dutch art, Belgian art, which is, each has its own liberty. So I believe still in the universal culture. And in the Enlightenment, and in Diderot and Voltaire. And what I see here is it's breaking down. And I don't believe that that's necessarily a good thing. Although it may seem to be good at the moment. At the moment it seems very good because it's maybe important that people realize that there's more than just a few big countries. But it is the function of the small countries in some way to look at the big countries too. And it is the function of the small countries, the big countries look at the small countries. Anyway.
We're sitting on the steps of the German Pavilion, and in the background we can hear people walk over Hans Hacker's piece. I must say I find it very impressive. What's your view of it?
It is grand. It's theatre in the grand style. It's a very... And of course, Mr. Hitler is a very helpful character. I mean, you can beat him as an actor. Mm-hmm. You could make 100 photographs of Mussolini visiting the Italian Pavilion, but he would be nowhere compared to Hitler. Stalin is not so bad with Kabakov.
So is the model of the Biennale something that you have confidence in, or do you think?
I think the Biennale should exist forever. I believe this is, the next time will be the 100th, the centenary. And I think it is very important. It's very important that a Biennale like this, an exhibition like this, which kind of celebrates modern art, continues. And that the Biennale will always be there to give confidence in art. This is one place for every 2 years where art people can enjoy themselves, enjoy the sunshine. The English complain because it's too humid or not cold enough, and so on and so on. And the Americans complain about the food because it's too rich in olive oil. And it's all part of it. So, and we need this Biennale, however bad it may be, to remember us that we as a minority have also basic rights, like women, blacks, and anybody else.
But
Jan,
this
is Jan Hoot. You know Jan Hoot?
Oh, Jan Hoot. Yeah,
this is Jan Hoot.
Yes. Yeah. I think it has been Biennale of Venice has been installed in order to get out of the dilemma of the nationalism. And now we are busy to install it again. That's the great problem. That's the dilemma of today. And then a nationalism without any ideology. Without any ideology, I think.
Do you think
as in the 19th century. And ideology has found his surrogate in the democracy of the 20th century. And democracy has not been used in the right way, I think, to be an abstract language. Only used as a tool to make everything which is banal more celebrated.
It's interesting to bump into you here, and I can't help thinking about comparisons since you were the director of Documenta 9. Obviously, there are very different constraints on each of the major exhibitions, but is there a way in which you can talk about the identities and distinctions and how they reflect contemporary art, contemporary culture? On the one hand, the Documenta, which is an individual curatorial activity, and Venice Biennale, which is a composite of curatorial interests.
Based on the foundations of the individual creation of the artist, Documenta, it was a dialogue between the curator and the artist. And that was the risk I took. I didn't make a Documenta which was an imperative. Looking through the eyes of one person. It was so many persons. So it was a Documenta which was the synthesis of the relationship between the maker and the maker of an exhibition and the maker of the art. And it was a very much driven exhibition, trying to confront the German love for perfection with a with a physical confrontation regarding the dilemma of it. Hans Hager never would have done this work if he wouldn't have seen the Documenta, because it's very physical. The problem is, that's too obvious.
Do you think so?
It's too obvious. It's based on the nostalgia nostalgia on history. And we have to get out of the dilemma. He is in the dilemma. He is confronting us with the dilemma in a direct way, not in trying to give the proposal how to get out, that he doesn't do. He crashed everything in the history, and I think we have to get out. It's too long, you know. My God. When the Second World War will be finished, that's my question, and that I'm looking in the art. And in Documenta, it was more warning the people for the danger that we cannot get out of the dilemma. And here, we are confronted with the dilemma, direct.
Apart from Hans Hacker and the sounds we can hear in the background, can you be specific about any other part of Venice
Biennale? I like very much Kabakov, for example. I like Kirkby. I like Kunelis. I like Tapies. It's marvelous how he did Tapies. Such a young artist. Okay. But I like very much Kabakov because it's ambiguous. It's about structure, it's about chaos, and it's about order, and it's about establishment, and it's about democracy, it's about ideology, all these issues. He brought it all together in one beautiful poetry, and that's unbelievable.
Let me ask you another, perhaps a final question. I mean, you were director of Documenta. I mean, had you been director of this Venice Biennale, how would it have been different?
It's very difficult, I have to say, because the Biennale of Venice has to deal with all the political issues because of the pavilions. They're all installed outside, independently of your dialogue, and that's a great problem. Some of them, they were involved in the issue, in the item, but many of them, they are making their own way only to celebrate. Biennale is oft there to celebrate the artists of the country or to celebrate the country.
Sure.
And that's a little bit of a problematic thing. More and more. Nevertheless, it's always interesting to see a biennale because you see so many things and you see so many artists, how they deal with a kind of command, because a command is a kind of frame they have to deal with. And some artists can find this free place, give a sign for the future.